Good morning, Roger. Good morning, world. Good morning, WGN audience, the best audience in the country. And indeed, we're here for our weekly get-together to talk about the world's most basic industry, agriculture, producing food to feed people. And we're in the middle of summer and middle of farmers market season, middle of county and state fair season. A lot going on that we'll be talking about between now and 6 o'clock this morning. We were at the state fair on Tuesday and visited with a lot of people we see once a year at state fair time, but there are some interesting things going on the Illinois State Fairgrounds, and we're going to begin this morning by talking about one of those activities involving a historic building on the Illinois State Fairgrounds. So stay with us. We'll get to that and more when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show. There are a lot of state fairgrounds and county fairgrounds in existence across America, and many of them have been doing it for a century or more, which has led to a lot of deterioration in some important buildings on these fairgrounds. And they're doing something about it. At the Illinois State Fair in Springfield, we're sitting down in the Coliseum with Warren Goach, who is Deputy Director of the Illinois Department of Agriculture. Let's begin, Warren, by talking some of the history and appearances in this Coliseum.
Well, this Coliseum has been around a long, long time. It was built in the early 1900s, I believe 1902 or 1903, and it has hosted tens of thousands of contests over the years. It has actually had other great events. John F. Kennedy actually spoke here to a large group about a year before he was assassinated. The history of this structure is just incredible.
But mainly used for livestock events.
Yes, we have several horse events, equestrian events throughout the year. This facility is used about 9 to 10 months a year. It's kind of an international and internationally known facility.
But for 2 years, it's pretty much stood empty because of the deterioration of the structure. And you're doing something about it. What are we going to do to this building over the next year or two?
Well, right now, we're in the process of finishing up the restoration design work. We have an architect engineering firm that's been employed. We hope to start construction here later in the fall or early winter. The whole roof, the whole top of this structure is going to be taken down, all the steel up above replaced, and the re-insulated and restored back to its original appearance.
And hoping to make it a year-round facility that can be used?
Yeah, well, the restoration is going to be in two phases. The second phase will include air conditioning and heating with the hope of making this a year-round facility.
But your efforts got a big boost today at the Illinois State Fair by the governor. What happened?
Well, the governor announced that he's making a personal donation of $1 million to the Fair Foundation. The Fair Foundation was set up, I believe, 2 years ago to allow anyone the opportunity to support restoration work here on the fairgrounds, and I'm sure that everyone is excited that the governor has made this commitment.
And in addition to the Coliseum, there will be improvements made in quite a few other buildings.
Yes, we were very fortunate to be included in the state budget this year, a $30 million appropriation for capital improvements on the fairgrounds. We've already repaved three streets, Main Street, Central Avenue, and Grandstand, Illinois Avenues. We hope to see a significant number of roofs replaced. We'd like to see some additional road work done. We want to work on the multipurpose arena and certainly the grandstand. So we have a lot of hopes, and if we can make these things all come together, I think you're going to see some significant improvements on the grounds.
And probably give hope to a lot of other state fairgrounds and county fairgrounds across the country that you can do it.
Yes, I believe we can. These are historic structures. They mean a lot to a lot of people. You can't go down the street during the state fair and not see someone that has a fond memory about some activity, whether it was receiving a blue ribbon in the Coliseum or competing in the Junior Livestock Building or over in the Hobby Arts and Crafts Building. I mean, just some tremendous memories, and we'd like to see more memories made for the next generation.
We'll be back next year to see if the memory is certainly being built, and we thank you for your time as we look at a historic building on the Illinois State Fairgrounds that will be back to looking like new. Warren Goetsch, who is the Deputy Director of the Illinois Department of Agriculture. To me, a lot of the county state fair activity focuses on young people, members of the 4-H and members of the FFA. And again, they had quite a year, and a lot of them were involved in the sale of the grand champions. The one thing I noticed this year that, well, maybe it's been happening before, but it was certainly noticeable this year. The age of the 4-H and, well, the 4-H members particularly, getting lower and lower. We had grand champion exhibitors that were 11 years old, 12 years old, 13, 14, and up to 15. And I don't recall seeing that many very young people in the show ring at the Illinois State Fair or at other state fairs. So these kids are getting younger and younger every year, it seems. We're going to share some of the results of the sale of grand champions with you. But before that, we're going to visit with a gentleman who is deeply involved in the marketing of those animals and other farm products, and who's become a regular goer to the Illinois State Fair. We'll do that when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. A visit to the Illinois State Fair is not complete without a visit with Tim Andreessen. He's involved in the agricultural commodity group at the CME Group. And you're back here at the fair and several other fairs continuing your education program?
Yeah, this is the sixth year of the Commodity Carnival program. This year we're going to be at 100 fairs in 8 different states.
And in addition to that, scholarships and spending money on some of the champions?
Well, look, we're big advocates of promoting education in the agricultural space. This year we're going to give out roughly $60,000 in scholarships. So every one of the 10 grand champions is going to get a $5,000 scholarship. And then the skillathons, which is, you know, for the people who may not necessarily have an animal, we're going to give out 9 $1,000 scholarships for that. And there's a rumor we may be bidding on one of the animals, too.
I've heard that rumor, Tim, and you have certainly in past years. What about the participation and the involvement in your risk management education program?
Look, it's been tremendously successful. We think we've reached about 325,000 people over this period of time. And a lot of that credit goes to, you look back there and you look at those 4-H volunteers who are at all of these fairs running this program. You know, we're really happy with the response that we've gotten from this. And for the people who haven't or can't come to the fair, don't forget we also have an app. We have our award-winning Risk Ranch app, which has been downloaded over 10,000 times in 115 different countries.
So are you international with your education programs, or is it strictly a U.S. program?
Well, the international programs are a little bit different. I mean, we definitely do have an international dimension. So, for example, for college-age kids, one of the things we have is the Trading Challenge. And this is a contest where colleges around the world put together teams that trade and, you know, try to compete against each other for the kudos of being the top trading team. So that's very international. And then the other thing we do a lot of is really more educating customers, where we'll work with different organizations. For example, a lot in Asia we do with USSEC, U.S. Soybean Export Council,
right,
where we'll put together programs with them where they will provide part of the content, we'll provide part of the education content, and we'll target on end users of U.S. products, in this case, obviously, soybeans.
And we, of course, are going through a tempestuous time in the grain market particularly. I look at it as my dad is bigger than your dad as we go back and forth on this. But are you able to use any of this activity in your education programs on risk?
Well, I think the educational takeaway about what's going on is, you know, there's definitely times when the market's very focused on things like water, with weather or supply and demand. But there's also, we should never forget, there's geopolitical risk. You know, and we haven't seen it. I mean, you and I go back long enough to remember wheat embargoes.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Russian wheat embargoes and things like that. We haven't seen so much of that lately. But, you know, now we're again seeing a situation where trade is having a, you know, trade politics is having a major impact on not necessarily the fact that so many soybeans are going to be consumed, but where are they going to come from? What is the trade path going to be? And whenever you start to inject that kind of uncertainty in the marketplace, it creates risk and it creates a need to understand risk management.
Well, I'm so delighted that CME Group is carrying on the education program, because over the years, you know, I heard from farmers, oh, that's a bunch of guys in suits and they're making money off me, but I think we've gotten away from that kind of thinking.
You know, we've been involved with agriculture for over 170 years, and at the end of the day, the most important customer to us is the commercial ag participant. Okay, our job is to provide them with a place to manage risk. And, you know, the world's changed, the structure of the market has changed. You know, it's more electronic and increasingly electronic every day. The products have changed. You know, case in point, as we think more about the global marketplace, we're very focused on regional products. So one of the things I mentioned to you is we have what we think is the beginning of a very, very successful product for producers in the Black Sea region for wheat. Last year, we launched a Black Sea wheat contract. Now, it's not the size of a Chicago contract or the Kansas City contract, but, you know, we've traded over 80,000 contracts. We have 30,000, give or take, open interest. We trade every day. So, you know, the idea of providing risk management to regional market participants is something that we're very focused on.
One of the final questions dealing with that Black Sea, is it traded by people in that part of the world, or do U.S. people get involved in that trade?
Well, it's interesting because as you look at who's trading it, we're seeing a cross-section. Interestingly enough, one of the things we see a lot of is the Australians trading it, because the Australians and the Black Sea compete for wheat exports. So you're seeing them trade back and forth. We are seeing a lot of American firms trade it as well, because a lot of the multinationals, and including some of the really big co-ops, have activities in that part of the world. So if you look at wheat, what you're starting to see is people to understand it is truly an international product, and they can manage that international risk by trading the different contracts.
Tim, always a pleasure. It wouldn't be a state fair without you, so thank you. And we look forward to seeing you at Farm Broadcasting Convention in November.
Look forward to seeing you too, Ori, and take care.
Tim Andreessen with the CME Group here at the Illinois State Fair.
Some call it the World's Fair of Agriculture, the Farm Progress Show, and it's coming quickly, the 28th through the 30th at the permanent site near Boone, Iowa. It's the place to be to see the latest equipment and services available to growers. The new technology gets unveiled here, and you farmers can check it out up close and personal in the daily field demonstrations and the ride and drive opportunities. Not only will combines and tillage equipment be demonstrated each day, but the tiling equipment will be in the fields too, with mains and laterals being installed to see the possibilities for drainage in your fields. We'll be there, Samuelson and Armstrong, Tuesday, August 28th at the hospitality tent at high noon. In fact, all 3 days at noon, the 28th through the 30th, our stage will be full with special guests. Come see us at the Farm Progress Show, Boone, Iowa. Again, it's August 28th, 29th, and 30th. Get more information at the website, farmprogressshow.com. You can map your show visit and order your tickets, too, at farmprogressshow.com. We hope to see you there.
27 minutes after 5 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show, going into a weekend that weather-wise looks pretty good for going to county fairs and state fairs and farmers markets and all of those activities. During our visit with Tim Andreessen, he said there was a rumor that maybe the CME Group would be bidding on one of the live grand champions, and indeed they did successfully. They paid $25,000 for the grand champion Barrow. And again, I must explain for our non-farm city listeners, I'm not saying barrel, I'm saying barrow, and that is a hog. They paid $25,000 for the barrow shown by Ella Bobel of Logan County, Illinois. We'll cover some of the other prices too. Grand Champion Rabbit Market Pen, $3,500. Grand Champion Poultry Market Pen, $4,000. That the poultry shown by Grant Wilderman of Bond County, the rabbit champion shown by Sam Pree in Iroquois County, the Land of Lincoln Supreme Champion Dairy Cow shown by Sarah Irwin of Logan County, Grand Champion Meat Goat and Land of Lincoln Grand Champion Meat Goat sold by Chase Tomhave of Morgan County, paid $11,300 for that champion, and the Land of Lincoln Grand Champion Weather, and oh, by the way, that's a lamb, brought $7,250 to Olivia Caldwell, the exhibitor from Peoria County. Grand Champion Weather, shown by Bryce Clayton of Scott County, brought $8,500. The Land of Lincoln Grand Champion Barrow, shown by Morgan Wagner of Fulton County, $15,500. And I mentioned the Grand Champion Barrow, purchased by the CME Group. The Land of Lincoln Grand Champion Steer, shown by Tara Hummel of Kankakee County, $30,000. And Governor Rauner spent quite a bit of money out of his bank account at the state fair on Tuesday. He and Mrs. Rauner paid $60,000 for the grand champion steer shown by Adam Miller of Livingston County. He is an eighth grader at the El Paso Gridley Junior High School. And he led that 1,311-pound crossbred steer named Taco, which Adam said was named after a Dallas Cowboy player. And he did it successfully, and the governor and Mrs. Rauner paid $60,000. The governor also committed, out of his funds, $1 million to the ongoing renovation of the Coliseum that we talked about earlier. 5:30 here on the Saturday morning show, and time to take a break for news headlines and say again good morning to Roger. Thank you, Roger. 24 minutes before 6 o'clock, and during this portion of the Saturday morning show, we'll talk markets as Max Armstrong sits down with Clayton Pope of Clayton Pope Commodities based in Champaign, Illinois, to take a look at what's going on with tariffs and retaliation and all that sort of thing impacting the agricultural commodity markets. But right now, we say welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I am Orion Samuelson, and I share thoughts with you every week on Samuelson Says. And this morning, we talk about keeping farm people safe. If you're looking for an easy way to keep your toilet bowls rust-free, I have the answer. Rust Guard is the in-tank toilet bowl cleaner that protects against rust and hard water stains with every flush. And Rust Guard is safe to use on plumbing and septic systems, and it will not harm pets. That's Rust Guard. Check us out at wink.com. That's WHINK.com. A few weeks ago on Samuelson Says, I devoted some thoughts to the increased danger on rural roads in farm country because of the tall corn at four-way intersections that cut visibility to zero for approaching automobiles to intersections with or without a stop sign. Frankly, I was surprised at the amount of reaction to that Samuelson Says discussion, and I want to share just one of them with you this week. This came from Scott and Terry Larson in Stromsburg, Nebraska, who said, "I caught your Sam Says this morning. Thank you for your promotion on blind intersections. My wife just put a sign up on our corner in memory of our daughter, and they sent me a photograph of the sign and the cornfield. And let me quote the sign: save a life, stop and look twice, in loving memory of those who were killed at blind intersections." And the name of their daughter, Lindsay Larson, born in 1993, died in 2014. And what an impression it made on me, and I hope it does on you. And I'll just repeat basically the message. If you're a farmer, a good idea to trim those cornfields next to a four-way intersection so that motorists can see. And if you're a motorist in the country, treat a four-way intersection as a stop sign always, because with the tall corn, your visibility is cut to zero for approaching automobiles. So my thanks to the Larson family for sharing that tragedy and for doing what they're doing to call attention to the fact that those country roads can be dangerous sometime, and particularly now with the corn crop in full maturity. So be careful out there. My thoughts on Samuelson Says. It's a presentation of Tribune Radio Networks at 20 minutes before 6 here on the Saturday morning show. A couple of other items I want to mention from my visit to the Illinois State Fair on Tuesday. Incidentally, we flew down in Air Orion at about 3,500 feet from Huntley down to Springfield, Illinois, and that landscape below us, lush and green. I was reminded by some people in the state fair that if I'd gone further west, I'd see a little more brown in some of those fields, but our flight path took us over some pretty good-looking agricultural production fields. But at the state fair, in addition to recognizing the young exhibitors of commodities and the grand champions, oh, and incidentally, finally, again, blue cheese was entered in the commodity section, and Gloria and I bought the blue cheese, which was produced in Faribault, Minnesota, by a facility owned by Prairie Farms Dairy. And so we paid, $800 for a five-pound wheel of blue cheese, and we're looking forward to it. Presiding over all of the fair activity at Springfield, she'll do the same at DuCoyne when that fair comes up later, is Miss Illinois County Fair Queen Samantha Hasselbrink. She's from Cisna Park, Illinois, represented the Iroquois County Fair at the annual pageant held during the 108th Illinois Association of Agricultural Fairs Convention in January. She presides over both of those fairs as the 59th Miss Illinois County Fair Queen. And then the other recognition, the Robert Wiseman family. They served as the grand marshals of the State Fair Twilight Parade on Thursday. They farm outside Belmont in Wabash County. Recognized this year, get this, as a bicentennial farm. The Wiseman Farm is one of only two farms in Illinois that have been owned by the same family for two centuries or more. The Wiseman Farm in the family since Illinois' founding as a state in 1818. And so they celebrated 200 years of farm ownership of the same property. And then another special farm family this year, the Illinois Department of Agriculture recognized its 10,000th centennial farm. 10,000 farms across the state that the same families have kept going for a century. Truly amazing. All right, Max Armstrong standing by to talk markets with Clayton Pope, and we'll get to that visit when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show.
Visiting with us about the market scene this weekend, Clayton Pope. Clayton Pope Commodities, Champaign County, Illinois, right in the heart of the Corn Belt. I was there the other day. Doggone it, from the road, it all looks mighty fine.
It does, Max, no doubt about that. But, boy, I hear just from more and more producers that it's not quite as much as it would appear to be. You know, when you get out there and start peeling back the ears and look at them, I mean, certainly there are those that are real proud of their crop and are talking about potential record production year, but there's an awful lot of people that are insisting that it's just not there.
The heat, the late heat, the heat even this week. I saw some commentary from North Dakota about how soybean yields perhaps are being trimmed by hot weather there. What do you make of that? Is, in fact, will we in September see smaller yield estimates because of the late heat?
I have to think we will. I mean, when you consider that this report that came out last Friday is, you know, basically as of August 1st, I mean, for one thing, things have changed a lot since then. The rain has definitely been less than average and less than called for in a lot of cases. Even the current system going through right now, I mean, it's sort of been delayed by 24 to 36 hours, and it just makes it that much more iffy, you know, whether those forecast totals are going to come about or not. But besides that, I mean, for one thing, the methodology of the way they approach that August report, particularly as far as the corn yield goes, you know, the way it is basically a population study. And as such, I think there's a lot to be discovered still once you get out there and into the actual plant.
It's the USDA numbers that really matter at the end of the day. But between that August report of a few days ago and the one coming up in September, we'll have these crop tours. We'll have analysts and grain folks and a bunch of journalists and some folks from other countries going out into the fields and looking around to say, well, oh, don't think it's there. Oh, no, we found the best yields ever out here.
Oh, I know it.
It kind of whipsaws the market a little bit here for a few weeks.
It definitely will. And I think this is probably one of the most impactful years in recent memory as far as the effect of some of those private crop tours. You know, it's going to be watched with the microscope, I think, by the trade. We've certainly heard a few early ones that did come up short. You know, some of the farmers in the area, even in like Douglas County, Illinois, as a matter of fact, they had a recent crop tour and were pretty surprised that the results weren't better than they were. So we'll see. But there's also this big misconception, not among farmers, but I think maybe like the, you know, just the public in general, that think that, well, as long as it pollinated okay, everything's fine, and the corn crop is what it is. And boy, nothing could be further from the truth. There is still a huge amount of variability that comes into play even after pollination, and let alone the fact that pollination itself this year was questionable. I mean, we've had some real temperature extremes this year. You know, too cold, too hot, and even though the pollination two, three week period itself didn't seem particularly damaging, you know, there's enough ifs, ands, or buts there that certainly puts a huge question mark. Personally, I think that yield that we saw for corn is the highest we'll see all year. I can't imagine the corn number won't come down. And I think the beans are still very much a work in progress.
And we should hasten to point out, while we're questioning yield numbers, in the past week, there have been some good moisture amounts. Several of my farmer friends weighed in either by social media or phone or text to me after moisture had moved through good rains. I mean, 2 inches in some spots, mm-hmm. and it came in a nice fashion and settled right into some bean fields, and they were delighted about it.
Central Illinois, West Central Indiana. I had a gentleman in West Central Indiana tell me this week it's probably one of the best crops ever around him. He's in the grain business.
Yeah, I can't doubt that at all. But here again, you'll talk to, and I was certainly under that impression as far as, say, West Central Indiana, you know, Lafayette area, Indianapolis to Lafayette, you know, Crawfordsville, that whole circle in there. You look at a map, and the moisture anomalies there have been excellent. You
know, and up toward Kentland, Newton County,
right,
that
right.
area.
Yeah, excellent, you would think. But again, you talk to some of the producers in that area, certainly some of them are, you know, pounding their chests, you know, this is amazing. But there again, I don't think you can paint it with a broad brush and just say they're all good. Even there's some trouble spots there, too. Again, the kind of thing where it looks good from the road, but you get out there and they're a little disappointed when they start tearing apart those ears.
Let's switch gears for a moment. Let's talk about, of course, there's so much to talk about in terms of the trade wars, the negotiations. We're seeing some optimism coming along here that this may not be such a long, arduous a path that we travel, such a dark tunnel for a long period of time. How do you sort all of that out on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis, Clayton? I mean, the trade obviously, you know, watches for every bit of news it can get. What's a farmer to do in this kind of
landscape? Oh, brother. Oh, that is the million-dollar question. I tell you, it's amazing. It wasn't that many months ago. Everybody was crying about the utter lack of volatility in these markets. And right now, boy, you be careful what you wish for, because it's off the charts, the uncertainty. I mean, yield is a huge question still at this point, and then the demand end of it, you know, vis-a-vis tariffs. Yeah, no kidding. How does a farmer approach that? Well, you got to take baby steps, obviously, and I think most people have kind of been trained into that approach anyway. But I don't know. I think one thing I want to keep in mind is the idea that China is going to come back 100% to, you know, that original export forecast that the USDA started off with, which was, what, 2.250 billion bushels, and they slashed 250 off of it in the July report. Personally, I'm highly skeptical that we'll ever jump up to that high of a number again, this year. I just think China showed a very, very strong pattern of shunning us. Even if the, you know, these talks are successful, quote unquote, you know, to think that they're, you know, a lot of people, I think, are thinking, you know, maybe that September or October report, bam, USDA will added 20 on Friday. So, you know, that missing 230 million bushels is going to miraculously appear. I don't think that's going to happen. No question. I think we've all done the math. We see it's going to be difficult for China to totally forego U.S. beans. I don't think there's any question they'll buy some, even if it's indirectly, which we've certainly seen signs of that, where, you know, they buy beans from Canada and Canada buys them from us, or, you know, whatever. But, you know, for them to come back in full force like that, I don't think it's going to happen. So I would kind of temper my optimism on that no matter what happens on these talks at the end of the month, which are just talks about talks. I mean, obviously, it's not a buying delegation.
Aren't there cargoes moving to China, U.S.?
There are.
Soybeans.
There's one
went out of the Pacific Northwest a few days ago.
Right, right. And supposedly there are, you know, photos of, you know, U.S. ships unloading actually in China as well over the last week. So, yeah, it slowed down to a trickle, I guess probably the best way to put it, but there's not an absolute brick wall between the two countries right now is probably the best way to describe it, I think.
The European drought and Ukraine, have we fully assessed the damage there yet, and could that perhaps hold at least some glimmer of hope for United States farmers?
Yeah, mostly on the feed grain side of it, but have we full? I would guess, if I had to guess, I'd say we probably are close to having fully factored in the damage to their production numbers. But the big question remaining, hanging over the market, is how much of that's going to translate into, you know, our export markets. You know, if you remember, 5 months ago or so, when the USDA raised our corn export numbers substantially, I was a real doubting Thomas. I thought you were going to have record weekly inspections from here on out to hit that target. It isn't going to happen. Well, it did happen, I got to admit. And so I don't want to dismiss, even though there's no signs of that happening yet in wheat, corn kind of pulled off a miracle on the demand front, and I'm extremely bullish on our corn demand outlook, you know, going forward. And so wheat, as much as the you know, the demand has failed to materialize so far. After what I just witnessed in Corna, I don't want to write it off. I mean, so your question, I think the production drop has been factored in, but how much business is going to come to us? No, that's not factored in yet and remains to be seen if it's going to happen.
I was visiting with my brother the other day. He was asking me about the long-term impact of these kinds of trade actions. And I told him I was clearly worried about it. I said, you know, when we've seen what's happened in the past, when we've taken dramatic actions to halt trading with someone, it's had a very long tail that has ultimately hurt the American farmer. What do you think? You've been around. You've watched this game a long time, Clayton. What's going to be the long-term effect of this? Have we done irreparable damage to our share of the world grain market?
Yes, Max, I have been around a long time and witnessed a lot of these things firsthand. You know, the Carter embargo and you know, other instances like that. I would have to think the real frank answer is, yeah, I think we've done some long-term damage. We've put a dent in our credibility as a you know, the guy who will always be there with the supplies, and to make that kind of a political football, you know, regardless of, you know, how you feel about it politically, I don't think there's any question it's harmed our reputation and reliability going forward.
The sobering story I saw the other day was the amount of Chinese investment now being ratcheted up. The investment, not here, but in agriculture in the Southern Hemisphere. And the story pointed out that clearly they were going to continue to improve their investment, as the Japanese did down there a couple of decades ago on the heels of our trade sanctions in the 70s. And I just wonder about how much it could hurt us long term on down the road.
Right. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, I think China was already in fourth gear, you know, developing alternative sources, particularly South America, and even, you know, there's talk about, you know, boosting agriculture in Africa and all that. And so I think that all this did was put it in fifth gear. You know, they got the pedal to the metal, I think. The flip side of it, though, on the positive side, is that, you know, the world's not getting – the global population isn't getting any smaller. And the standard of living, for the most part, seems to be rising in so many areas. And as such, I think, you know, demand is on a upward trending path, which is certainly encouraging. So even though, you know, other supply sources are being pursued by China and will continue to develop. I mean, we're expecting record acreage in South America again, which is no surprise, certainly. You know, we got more mouths to feed and feeding them better food, too. So, you know, that's the flip on it. And so it's difficult to come up with, you know, a real dire or positive conclusion on the whole thing. It's always been a net between the two.
I always appreciate the chance to pick your brain a little bit, sir. Thanks for coming in to be with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Clayton Pope, Clayton Pope Commodities.
Farming is a competitive business, and you need every advantage you can get if you want to lead the field, which is why more and more farmers across America are entrusting their crop handling to Brandt. Brandt has earned a superb reputation on the Canadian prairies, and now they've set up shop right in the heart of the U.S. Corn Belt, turning out made in the USA swing-away augers and other products specifically for U.S. corn and soybean growers at their 200,000 square foot plant in Bloomington, Illinois. Get the story firsthand at the Farm Progress Show at Boone, August 28th through the 30th. You'll see Brandt grain carts at the Combine demos each day at 11.